This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. It's always exciting attracting new talent to your organization, and that can be especially true if doing so weakens a rival in the process. But attracting top performers in this manner can sometimes bring unwanted legal repercussions. On this podcast, we'll examine those repercussions, plus other notable risks that can arise when hiring employees. And we'll discuss practical HR solutions to steer clear of trouble with Texas employment attorney Mary Nix. Mary practices in Dallas with Munch, Hart, Kopf, and Haar, one of the largest firms in the Lone Star State, where she represents employers. She has litigated and arbitrated a host of restrictive covenant, unfair competition, and trade secret cases, and we're happy to have her with us for a close look at these issues. Mary, welcome.
Thank you so much, David. I'm excited to be here today.
Well, it's great to have you, and I'll start with this. Unless you're plucking a high-level performer from the unemployment line, that individual is very likely leaving another job to join your company. So with that said, what's the biggest risk that you see in hiring someone away from a competitor?
There are a few issues that the employer should be considering, David, when hiring a key employee. The first is the possibility that the potential employee has obtained and retained confidential information or even trade secrets from a prior employer and has plans to use that to his or her advantage at a new business. Another issue is whether or not the new employee has signed contracts with a prior employer which contain restrictive covenants. The most common restrictive covenant is a non-compete agreement. Other restrictive covenants that the employer should be looking for are non-solicitation agreements, limiting the ability of the new employee to solicit clients and employees from the former employer, and then confidentiality agreements. And then there is a third concern. It's less common, but important nonetheless, and that is whether or not the new employee entered into other agreements that may contain restrictive covenants. The new employee may have done so individually or through an affiliated business. Employers don't typically think to ask for those agreements, but they should. And those can include consulting agreements, independent contractor agreements, or operating agreements, among others.
Well, let's talk a bit about restrictive covenants because it's a pretty hot topic these days. And an employer can be subject to litigation not only if it knew of a restrictive covenant and ignored it, but even if it should have known. So what's the best way for an employer to find out this information before a problem arises?
David, the most typical claim by a former employer against a new employer is called tortious interference with an existing contract. Now, in Texas, the questions that will arise if that claim is made are fourfold. One, does the plaintiff, that is the former employer, have a valid contract with its former employee? Two, did the new employer willfully and intentionally interfere with that contract? Three, did the interference cause damage to the former employer? And then four, what was the damage that was caused? Now, that claim, tortious interference with an existing contract, is common in most states in the country, and the elements are somewhat similar in all states. And as you accurately point out, David, the former employer does not have to prove that the new employer had actual knowledge of the contract at issue, but really only has to prove that the new employer had knowledge of facts or circumstances that would lead a reasonable employer to believe that there is a contract in which a former employer or a third party may have interest. Before I get into a little more detail on that very issue, the words willful and intentional are a bit misleading to the average employer because the former employer does not have to prove that the new employer intended to injure, but only that the new employer intended to do whatever act occurred that breached the agreement at issue. And to make it a little more simple, for example, it would only have to prove that the new employer intended to solicit a key customer of the former employer, not that it intended to injure the former employer by doing that. Or maybe the new employer intended to hire the new employee as, let's say, a salesperson in the same position and over the same region as held at the former employer. So really, it's not a very high standard to meet. And that's, I guess, David, a long-winded way of saying that it is very important to ask a potential new employee, particularly a candidate for a key position, to provide copies of any agreements they have signed with a former employer and any agreements they have signed with a third party that may have any impact on their job duties with your company.
Well, it certainly sounds like good advice. Mary, in your experience, have you heard of a horror story, for lack of a better word, that you could share of an employer that stole away an employee from a rival only to find itself enmeshed in litigation and finding that the cost outweighed the benefit?
Unfortunately, yes. I've represented several employers who have found themselves in that very situation, and I have been on the opposite side, representing the former employer who wants to protect itself and is going against the former employee and the new employer in a very aggressive manner. And for example, last year I represented one company who provides certain technology solutions to the oil and gas industry, and that company had a stronghold in Asia, and they were having a heck of a time competing in the North American market. They made a decision to target a key sales executive at its North American competitor, which happened to be my client, and it ended up, by doing that, we engaged in a three-state litigation to shut that down. We had cases going in California, Utah, and in Texas, and the cost was, I'm sure, extremely higher than they had ever intended or desired, and ended up, you know, shutting down that really unfair competition move.
Mary, you were speaking earlier about the importance of making sure that an employee doesn't have an agreement that might restrict him or her from competing against their former employer. Is getting that employee's express written representation that he or she isn't subject to a restrictive covenant the best approach to avoid litigation?
My preference, David, is to be more proactive if the employer really does want to avoid any possible litigation by asking the employee to make that type of written representation. You are relying on their interpretation, which is often faulty, as you can imagine. I prefer employers to specifically ask for copies of the following contracts signed by the key employee they want to hire: employment agreements, offer letters, non-compete agreements, restrictive covenants of any kind, independent contractor agreements, invention agreements or work-for-hire agreements, operating agreements, confidentiality agreements, consulting agreements, or stock or asset purchase agreements where the key employee sold any stock or assets related to a business operation. It is important to ask for those agreements specifically by name to make sure that no stone is left unturned and that the new employer is not leaving it in the hands of the new employee to guess as to whether or not a contract should be provided to the new employer. Sometimes the new employee will not have the actual agreement, but the employer does need to know if they signed one of those, because restrictive covenants are commonly found in these type of agreements, David.
On the other side of the coin, even though an employee signed a restrictive covenant, there have been cases where employers can overreach in drafting these clauses. What's something that would jump out at you in looking at one of these agreements and cause you to say, hey, wait a minute, this may not be enforceable against our new hire?
That's a great question, David. In my experience, the great majority of non-competes are overly broad in the scope of activities restrained. And the company drafting the agreement needs to remember that a non-compete will only be enforced to the extent that it is protecting interests which are reasonably protectable. For example, I've seen non-competes which typically say something like this: the employee will not, during employment and for 2 years post-termination, directly or indirectly engage in any business which provides, let's just use this as an example, staffing services to healthcare facilities or other healthcare organizations. Well, when you look at it through the lens of the company or the employer who's drafting it, that may seem very narrow. But when you look at it in the broader scope of the enforceability of that agreement, that is a very broad restriction which could be read to limit the employee unfairly, and it could be either held to be completely unenforceable, or a judge may instead elect to what we call blue pencil, where they change and rewrite the agreement. That's a very dangerous place for an employer to be who's drafted a non-compete, because typically if you can't draft it well enough for yourself where a judge has to redraft it for you, you're going to be stuck with the judge's interpretation of that agreement, not only to that employee, but potentially to all other employees who have signed a similar agreement.
And when you talk about these agreements sometimes being too broad, is geographic limitation or some other way something that you see most often as the way in which these go too far?
Well, it's twofold. It's an overbreadth in scope of the restriction of activities, like I just discussed, and then there could be overbreadth in the scope of geographic limitations. You don't see that too much anymore because of the way our businesses are run these days. They can be nationwide as opposed to regional or even worldwide. Typically, a judge will, what I call again, blue pencil or rewrite the contract to make that geographic restriction enforceable. But I don't usually see non-competes really turning on that issue. I see them more often turning on the issue of overbreadth and the scope of activities restrained, or the definition of competitor that the company uses to restrict the employee from going to work for another business.
Now, when it comes to non-competition agreements, since you practice in Texas, are there any unique considerations that Texas employers in particular need to be aware of?
Well, I think there is still a myth out there, David, that continues to surprise me, and that myth is that non-competes are not enforceable in Texas. And I don't know why that myth continues to this day, but nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, they are as enforceable or even more so here than in other states. The law has become more and more favorable to employers trying to enforce these type of agreements. So for Texas employers, making sure that they draft a non-compete agreement that is sufficiently narrow in scope so that it won't be questioned by a judge if it's ever challenged is really key. And it's key to get a lawyer involved in order to make sure that that agreement is narrowly tailored. And in many times, David, I would recommend that an employer get not just a transactional lawyer involved, but a lawyer who has actually been in the trenches and fought over these non-compete agreements in court or in arbitration so that they can really tell the employer how to draft that language in order to protect what that employer is really trying to protect.
Why do you think that myth is out there that non-competes aren't enforceable in Texas?
Well, many years ago, Texas had case law which said that a non-compete agreement would not be enforceable unless there was something provided in support of that non-compete. That issue still survives to this day. You can't get something without giving something, right? So there is that issue. But what people, I think, fail to realize is that a non-compete agreement is an agreement by an employee not to go work for a direct competitor, and that if defined well under the terms of the agreement. But the other restrictive covenants can overshadow the non-compete. So, for example, a non-solicitation agreement within an employment agreement will say typically that the employee cannot solicit current or prospective clients of a company, for example. And those are almost always enforceable to the extent that the employee can determine who those individuals or companies are. And I think that a lot of times either employers or employees get really caught up in the non-compete aspect of an employment agreement and forget that we have all these other components like a non-solicit, a confidentiality agreement, etc., that really can overshadow the non-compete aspect and keep someone from doing exactly what you're trying to keep them from doing, and that is taking your business, taking your confidential information, taking your customers.
Again, we're speaking with Mary Nix of the firm of Munch, Hart, Kopf & Haar in Dallas. And Mary, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about trade secrets, because that's an obvious concern in this area when an employee walks out the door. If you're the employer hiring away another's top performer, even if there's no restrictive covenant agreement in place, could you still be subject to a trade secrets lawsuit?
Absolutely. If a company accepts another company's trade secrets and then uses those trade secrets to its company's benefit, that is obviously going to open up a risk. Many employers know that a new employee has key information from a competitor and then hires that employee, hoping in part that the employee will use that information to his new employer's benefit. And the company's owners really cannot stick their head in the sand, David, and pretend that they do not know that this is or could be happening. And in fact, it is usually very easy for the former employer to figure out that the new employer is using its trade secrets. A few text messages, emails, and a forensic expert can assist the former employer, because the employee who has left has almost always left a trail of evidence behind. I had a case last year where the former employee had engaged in multiple text messages with his colleague over the course of several months. And he thought that all of those text messages had been erased, but unfortunately for him, but good for our client, they had not been. And we were able to obtain the phone through an emergency request for discovery, and the judge was very quick to provide that relief. And then once we were able to obtain the phone and get a forensic expert involved, we were able to download hundreds of text messages, which read like a novel, illustrating a number of meetings that were held, providing trade secret information and documents to the new employer while that key employee was still employed by my client.
Now, how about if you're on the other side representing the company that's losing the employee? What are the best practices or some other best practices to protect the employer's trade secrets?
Well, it is very important to immediately put the new employer on notice of any restrictive covenants signed by the employee. It's also important to lock down the former employee's computer and get a forensic copy of the hard drive made immediately so that it's protected. Also, going through emails, going through phone records, and if the phone that the former employee was using was purchased through the company, don't hesitate to take control of that phone and get it in the hands of a forensic expert as well. Another thing that it could be done, David, is to review customer contracts for inconsistencies or amendments that may have occurred that the company wasn't aware of. And I'm in a matter right now where an employee left, but during the 6 months prior to leaving, he went in and engaged in amendments of various contracts to make it easy for clients to get out of contracts with his former employer. And looking for inconsistencies, looking for evidence that something has happened, needs to be done really immediately within the first 30 days of that employee leaving, if the employer has any hope of protecting trade secrets that might have walked out the door.
Mary, are you seeing a lot more of these types of cases with the technology boom that we've been witnessing in recent years?
Oh, yes. I mean, information is more easily moved. It's very valuable. And it's just a very easy thing for an employee to do, is to move information from one company to another.
We only have about a minute or so left. So is there a final piece of advice that you could leave our listeners with on these issues involving restrictive covenants and trade secrets?
Yes, there is, David. One of the things that I highly recommend to employers, particularly if they are in a sales environment, which most are, in a technology environment, or if they have key processes and procedures that they don't want walking out the door, and that is to get an assessment of trade secrets and protections in place, an audit, if you will, and using an attorney and perhaps even a consultant in addition to an attorney in order to engage in that audit is really important. And the employer needs to make sure that they know that they can articulate clearly what are the company's trade secrets. What are its confidential information that it wants to protect? And then after they're able to do that, How has the company protected that information internally? Are those protections sufficient? And what other measures can be taken to protect that information, including restrictive covenant agreements, but also accessibility limits and other documentation of processes and procedures taken in order to protect that information?
Well, we'll let that be the last word. Mary Nix practices in Dallas with the firm of Munch, Hart, Kopf, and Haar, where she represents employers. Mary, thanks so much for the insights.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast as well. Continue checking our website regularly for more podcasts on hot-button employment topics affecting the world of HR. Recent programs include a look at the National Labor Relations Board's new election rules. The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR, our subscription offering, or our new 50-state employee handbook resource, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved.